the LCPFB Subcommittee on a Balanced Budget, co-chaired by Senator. You were in the House, I almost was representative, but that's a long time ago. Senator Pogamiller and myself. And today we have three main items on the agenda: review of the state's cash flow, continued discussion on the scenarios to address the budget deficit, the spreadsheet, if you will, that was presented the other day by Matt Mossman and Bill Marks. At that point in time, they indicated they were still working on it, so we'll see the updated version. And then a report on the 2010 supplementary budget instructions. So why don't we start with Commissioner Hansen and Budget Director Jim Showalter, and then we also will have a few comments from Commissioner Ward Ines relative to the delayed payments and any other issues related to that that may come forward. By way of background, we did submit a few questions to the commissioners in advance of the meeting, and so their testimony will probably center mainly on the questions that the co-chair submitted. Commissioner Hansen?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity to be here and to talk about cash flow. It is a follow-up. If you recall, in the waning days of the legislative session, we talked about this in detail with the full LCPFP. We had some discussions early in session, as well as some discussions with Senator Pogamiller and Speaker Kelleher since then. We have worked with your staff, Mr. Chairman, and have based our presentation on the memo that you and Senator Pogamiller sent to me on November 3rd, and I think it's in everybody's packets. And in a minute, I'll turn it over to our State Budget Director, Jim Showalter, who will carry forward the presentation, as well as Charlie Bielek, who is a 32-year employee of state government and has worked on cash flow most of that time, if not all of that time. So we have the benefit of – I asked Charlie when I got in this morning, how long had you worked for the state, and he looked at me and didn't want to tell me. But the benefit of having Mr. Bielek is that he has helped us and has a fairly good institutional memory on this issue. As we go forward, you will see.
How far back does that memory go?
76? Is that what you said?
But 76. Okay, then he's a short timer, but that's
fine. Yeah, well, yeah, it's for you, Mr. Chairman. But the reason I bring it up, jesting aside, Charlie was here during the 1980s and during some of the other times in our state's history where we had declines in revenue like we have now, and cash flow has been a challenge. You will see with the presentation of Mr. Showalter that we are, with the revenue update yesterday, $223 million. $223 behind what we projected we would be at this point last February from the February forecast. It's $142 million for fiscal 2009 and then $81 million now. And that has a direct impact on our cash flow as we go forward, and you will see that. With that, I will, for the details, I'll turn it over to Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Showalter, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. And if I may, I'd like to invite Charlie Bielek to the table
so that he
can help and co-present this information on cash flow. Is this microphone really loud? I'm hearing reverb as I'm sitting here. Cash flow is a fundamental financial management issue for the state, for other states, for other local units of government, for other businesses and entities. It's not something that we commonly discuss because it's really sort of in the administrative gears of how the state gets its job done. We typically talk about the budget, how much we're going to be spending in a year, how much we're going to be receiving in a year, whether we can balance those two things up. Cash flow takes it another step further. How much are we going to be receiving on a given day and the next day and then day after that? So how does the timing of those revenues and expenditures work out through the course of the year? it's fine to have a balanced budget, but if all your expenditures go out on the first day of the year and all your revenues come in at the last day of the year, you obviously have a big problem. Typically, the state has significant cash balances through what's known as the statutory general fund, and I'll explain that more in a little bit. But due to a considerable number of things, most notably economic stress, that cash balance has deteriorated over time, so that we're now looking really very persistently in trying to raise this issue with you so you understand the parameters, the choices, and the management options that we have to be looking at. If you can look to the slideshow that you have in front of you, the top slide presents cash balances on June 30th, 2009. That essentially says, at the end of the last fiscal year, what was our cash position by fund? You see, in the statutory general fund, which is an umbrella of the funds that are available underneath the commissioner's authority, that includes the general fund, healthcare access fund, health impact fund, a number of other funds, excludes the constitutional funds like the Trunk Highway Fund or pensions, excludes those types of funds. The statutory general fund had about $2.47 billion in cash. Some of the major funds are listed right below that, with the general fund having about $837 million, and you'll see the other balances in those other funds. All other funds had about $553 million, and that is many, many funds, like 70, 80 funds, all contributing to that single balance.
Mr. Showalter, are there other funds while you're on that point that cannot be used? You mentioned trunk highway funds and pension funds. Are there any others that you cannot use?
Mr. Chairman, members.
Those would be the two big ones, obviously.
The broad umbrella here is constitutionally dedicated funds, any trust funds, endowment funds, or the debt service funds. That is money that we borrow for capital projects. Those are all excluded from using the cash in those funds to offset general fund shortages.
Thank you.
Just a recap, too, when you look at generally accepted accounting principles, those are really defining what are some of the statutory general funds as well. And those are typical practices in this state as well as other states. So the balances at the beginning of the year had about $2.5 billion. It's a little less than we've had in previous years, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I want to take you to the next slide, which shows you where we are at right now. As of October 31st, the statutory general fund no longer has $2.5 billion. It has $986 million.
Are the slides supposed to be up on the screen?
We did not realize you were going to have overhead capability here, so we did not bring a slideshow. The $986 million is composed of the following balances: $165 million in the general fund, smaller balances in some of those other funds, with all other funds adding another $509 million. Now, that's the balance as of that date, but the only reason that the general fund had $165 million in it is that we lent from other funds $947 million, that far right-hand column. That shows the cumulative amounts that are essentially borrowed on a cash basis from other fund balances to the general fund. This is not unusual. This is actually a typical activity because the general fund has some of the most different cash swings throughout the course of the year. If you think about it, when are the income taxes coming in? They're coming in April. You're going to be doing some of your refunds before then. You're not going to be collecting the checks until April 15th or beyond that. So some of those major revenues come in at that point in the year. On the other hand, you have significant expenses in school aid payments, local aid payments, all largely front-loaded or tending to be in the first half of the year. So the general fund typically has a cyclicality that means that it's going to have lower cash balances through portions of the year. And for a number of years now, we've been borrowing between funds. What's unique here is that the level of borrowing between the general fund and the other funds and the level of balances in the other funds.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Silbert.
When you mentioned that payments to school districts, is that accounted for in the shift in this on these particular numbers, as, or does that show up yet on the obligation that you made payments to from the general fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I am hearing your question, is are the payments going out to school districts reflected in these figures?
Yeah, and does that include the shift?
Including payment delays, deferrals?
Right.
Yes, that includes this. So this is basically literally the checks that are going out to those school districts.
So if Mr. Chair, if we had not done the school shift, if the governor had not had the school shift, what would the cash flow look like then? How much has that been? Money that would normally have gone out.
We didn't do that shift.
Because those shifts are not all one-time shifts, they're
right.
Monthly shifts, if I recall right.
Mr. Chairman, members, the school shift has the following impact. What it does is it doesn't change necessarily the total for the year, but it does change the timing of payments. The practical impact of the property tax recognition piece of the school shift is to shift payments earlier into the state's fiscal year. So in our current estimates for the current year, the payments that were made July through October were higher than they normally would have been without the property tax recognition shift.
But how about the other part of the shift, Mr. Chair? The state shift. I mean, there's property tax recognition shift, but then how about the state shift? Is that
the aid payment
not included in that?
Mr. Chairman, the savings for the year, of course, are included as part of the balanced budget stuff. The amount of payments by month are not dramatically impacted by the payment date shift. So there is some impact.
Do we have a number of for that impact? Is it 50 million? Is it 100 million? Is it 200 million? So far.
Mr. Chairman, that's not something I have handy. No.
Mr. Chair, as Representative, if that's something you'd like us to follow up on, we can figure out how that would.
Why don't you provide that to the committee then?
And that raises a good point, because on the next slide, we're going to start to look at how we model this. If you look at the next page, you will see what we were anticipating. The 2010 statutory general fund balance to look like over the course of this year. Now, this is a simple summary level piece of information, and I'll get into it more in a second, but underneath it, I just want you to understand the level of complexity and estimates that are included herein. Robert Erickson, Marsha Battle-Jenks have been working on these estimates throughout the course of this year and in prior years as well. And it really is estimating on a daily basis when we expect major payments to go out, when we expect minor payments to go out, when we expect revenues, tax payments to come in, and literally picking the date. And that date specificity has a significant impact on what the low points are for any given month. The cyclicality is pretty much defined by the pattern of aid payments, of tax receipts, things like that. But the low points really come in and are very sensitive to the timing of when a specific revenue will come in and how that pairs up in any given month with the spending that goes on. So you look at this chart, for instance, in July, the far left-hand column, this line shows that we started with a balance of about $2.3 billion in the statutory general fund, but during the course of that month, its low point was more like $1.5 billion. So during that period of time, on a daily basis, that swung by, you know, nearly $800 million. With the midpoint, the ending cash balance being there, being that hatch mark, that being the ending mark for that particular month. But during the course of the year, that month, the balance was all across that period, all across that range. To the same extent, you see through the course of the year what we were projecting in the statutory general fund for the high balance, the low balance, and then the ending balance for that month. You'll see that it dips somewhat during the first part of the year, comes back up in January, and then retreats back again in March and April until you get to June, when you see a swing from a low balance of a little more than $400 million going all the way up to roughly $2 billion by the end of that month.
likes to have.
The timing, the daily timing, and the estimates of when things are going to happen and when they actually do happen have a strong impact on our cash management at NMMB and the cash balances that are held by the state. So this is the 2010 outlook. As you can see, the balances drive down so that we have some estimated low points in November and December. Those are what we're looking at right now, trying to manage through, figure out ways to minimize risk, and then looking ahead into March and April, how to manage through those, what are the forecast risks that we are likely to have here.
Mr. Chairman. Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Historically, in December you're going to have like a $500 million cash flow number with a multi-billion dollar business we're running. In the past years, how does that proportionately look? Is this low or looks pretty scary? Obviously, that's a big reason we're here, but that's a small number on a business we're running here they have in a bank.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, absolutely, and that is why we're here. That is exactly why we're here, because in the past our cash balances typically have been higher so that we did not need to, or it was not really a conversation point that really needed to draw your attention. At this point, the balances are small enough that you need to understand the implications, the budget impacts, and just sort of the long-range management things that are on the table at this point.
Seems that it's very scary, to say the least. So,
and Mr. Chair, Senator, I in some ways agree, but I also want to help you understand that this is not a unique situation, that states across the country have had their balances drawn down.
Well, we're not so that concerned about. We're concerned about Minnesota, obviously.
I agree.
You know, so.
And also, just so you also understand, one of the things we try to apply here, like we apply to the forecast, is good information. And we've been working at understanding the cash balances for years. Having a daily estimate helps at least helps us understand more clearly what the nature of the problem is. It's still scary, right? I'm not underestimating that. But at least we have some information about what we are anticipating in the next couple months with a certain level of confidence.
Mr. Chairman, just to emphasize one point on the chart we're looking at on page 2, that as Mr. Showalter said, it is a matter of timing for revenue collections and expenditures, but you also have to receive the revenue you anticipated you were going to get. So when we look ahead to December, January, and February, we base at this point on our February forecast. Soon it will be the November forecast, and we look ahead and we project what we're going to receive. And now thus far, as I mentioned when we began our talk, $223 million less than what we had anticipated in February. So it is a matter of timing, as Jim says, but it's also a matter of receiving what you thought you were going to get.
Mr. Chair, I think that's an important point here and a good transition between this chart and the next chart, because this chart is really what we thought at the end of session. This is what we presented to rating agencies at the time. Said there's cyclicality, that there's low points in fiscal 10, and we were watching our revenues very closely. That was really a key determination of how these balances would hold up. As you know, our monthly revenues haven't come in exactly as predicted. They've, in fact, come in somewhat lighter. So as a result, our cash position is a little worse than reflected on that chart. On the next page, you'll see the fiscal 2010 general fund high, low, and closing cash balances. And this actually is updated, includes actual balances through October. So that you'll see here how that the cash flow, cash position of the general fund, which was expected to have been negative by this point in time, was in fact going more significantly negative through October, will continue to dip in November when we have a significant one-time payment for debt to the debt service. Thank you for debt service, and then starts to build back up as revenues come in later in December and early January.
Mr. Chair, when is that payment due? The debt service payment?
December 1st.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up then. When are the payments due to counties and cities?
We have a chart. Mr. Chairman, members.
Will you address that later on?
Yeah.
Okay, then I'll hold the question.
Senator Pogman.
Schulter, when you said they were expected to go negative,
mm-hmm.
who expected that?
Mr. Chair, Majority Leader, this is the general fund, not the statutory general fund.
I understand.
This was in our cash flow projections. This was
the Finance Committee saw the yes. House and Senate Finance Committee saw a chart that projected that general fund cash flow would go negative.
Mr. Chair, Majority Leader, I can't tell you which charts you saw in the LCPFP or at the forecast time, whether they're a statutory general fund or general fund. That was certainly part of the discussion, and certainly that's been part of the practice over the last number of years. I know for certain we testified in front of the Senate Finance Committee January, and discussed that particular item. And certainly throughout the period, statutory general fund is what we manage to, but the general fund is always the net borrower in these instances.
A question when you talked about the management and the shifting of the funds, what are we losing in interest?
Mr. Chair?
What are those funds losing in interest, and how is that handled?
Mr. Chair, those funds that borrow money or lend money to the general fund lose nothing. They are still credited with the interest as if it were in their fund, so that when those funds are restored by the general fund and go back, the interest is still credited to those sourcing funds. The fund that loses interest is the one that's borrowing, because they, in fact, have lower cash balances than anticipated in this instance to be the general fund.
So let me ask that question then. How much interest is being lost to the general fund?
Mr. Chairman, members, it's worth an explanation of how interest is apportioned to funds. Again, if you look at the front page, and the bottom of the front page, the way that interest is actually calculated is earnings are calculated by the investment board on total invested treasurer's cash, the top number there, the $3.6 billion. And the interest is then apportioned, the total interest collected on all funds is apportioned to state funds that earn interest. Not all state funds earn interest. And the residual goes to the general fund. So any excess that is earned on total invested treasurer's cash that is left over after it is apportioned to those state funds that actually earn interest, the residual goes to the state general fund. In the example there, we have borrowed from Minsky a total of $330 million. On a monthly basis, the interest is still apportioned to the Minsky fund as though that cash were there. What it does is it reduces the residual interest that comes to the general fund. The other example that's worth pointing to is the HIF fund. For example, we borrow money from the HIF fund, but that fund does not earn interest. So any cash in the HIF fund, the interest indirectly comes directly to the general fund. So it's impossible to identify a specific number, but the funds that we borrow from essentially are held harmless. They continue to earn interest as though the cash were there.
Mr. Chairman, when you borrow money, it's going to cost you some money. I mean, you know, and they were going to earn money in those funds anyway. But now we're borrowing money. So I think Representative Carlson has a good question, but I'm not hearing the answer to it. I mean, it costs the taxpayers money to borrow money, and we're not getting an answer what those numbers are. That seems pretty clear to me that
Mr.
we're dancing around the costs of the borrowing.
Again, the question was, those funds that we borrow from, they're being held harmless. They're earning interest as though they were. Where you see the impact, Senator, Mr. Chair, is in the residual that comes to the general fund. The simple example here is last year, the general fund earned $40 million of investment income. Okay, this year, our estimate is $10 million. So there is a cost, and that cost is reflected to the general fund kind of in a back-end way, in that we're getting less. We're getting less in terms of investment income that ends up in the state general.
And that was essentially the question I was asking. I guess I had it. I assumed that the loss was coming to those funds that were providing the capital, but the general fund then is losing roughly $30 million if you compare it from biennium to biennium.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Metzen?
That's the answer, I guess. Yeah. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, just again looking at the general fund, you see the cyclicality in 2010. The pattern here is similar to what you've seen in previous years. It's just the level of cash that continues to get drawn down. And as we've spent our reserves, as our forecast continues to underperform, that just continues to put pressure on our cash balances. If you turn to the next page, you'll see a chart titled Estimated versus Actual Low Points. And this is just to help you understand the process that we go through to assess where we are at any point in time on our cash balances. On this chart, you'll see on a monthly basis, on the left-hand side, what the estimated low point for that month was. Low point being the dangerous part for us, because you can't miss the low point. The midpoint, the average, the ending point, while interesting and important, the low point is what we really need to manage against. You'll see the low point for July was, in fact, the actual was actually much better than anticipated by our projections. That isn't the case for most of the other months, however. You look in August, September, October, that the low point for the general fund, and again, this is just the general fund, not the statutory general fund, but for the general fund was lower than anticipated in October, was lower by nearly $200 million.
Mr. Chair, are the estimated based on the February forecast?
Mr. Chair, my representative, yes.
Okay.
February forecast for revenues, yeah. With any intervening legislation, administrative actions.
Well, estimations updated after the legislative session?
Mr. Chair, our representative, yes.
So we don't have a chart of the what the cash flow was in February, because there was obviously lots of cuts made. On allotments made after the legislative session. So are these reflective of? They're not reflective then of the February forecast, but reflective of the actions that were taken but updated.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, the revenue numbers are based upon the economic assumptions and the revenue assumptions. But with intervening actions, so it's an end of session.
So, do we have a chart of what the February forecast had on the cash flow, without those intermediate type of activities?
Mr. Chairman, members, no, we don't, and there's a simple reason for that. As you recall, what the February forecast, in November and the February forecast show, were large deficits, and it's extremely. All you would see on the cash flow is just. Reflecting those forecasts without action is just larger and larger and larger cash shortages. So we have to have some assumption as to what the budget will be in terms of to do cash flow estimates. What we did in January and in the May presentation was we showed you cash flow estimates based on the governor's budget proposal, and now these reflect end of session after the governor's allotments. So it's fairly difficult to do cash flow estimates on what is largely an unaddressed forecast deficit.
Okay, thank you.
So,
Senator Bogomiller.
So the negative cash flow charts that probably were shown to the Finance Committee were based on the governor's proposed budget, and they anticipated negative cash flow. The proposal to the legislature by the governor anticipated negative cash flow.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogomiller, that is correct, but those same charts showed it at a much more manageable level. As Mr. Showalter mentioned, it is common, and you'll see why later in the presentation, where the general fund does, just as a matter of its structure, go negative at various points in the year. Based on the governor's budget, it showed it going negative, but at a much more manageable level.
Senator Pogomiller.
I'm not going to ask you with your 30-some years experience what manageable means, because it's been tossed around a lot lately. And apparently deficits of $5 to $7 billion are manageable in some people's estimation.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogomiller, the reason we have a statutory general fund is to manage these issues across a broad spectrum of funds. And it has been that way for since you've been here, right, Charlie? The statutory general fund. It's a long-standing cash management. It's not something that we determined was manageable in the last year or two.
Yes, sir.
Well,
Senator Pogomiller.
Thank you, Commissioner, but that wasn't really the point. I think the point's pretty obvious, that we were presented with a budget that anticipated a negative cash flow.
Not in the statutory general fund. In the general fund.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, do we have that? What the low number was on that, the governor's budget, and as he presented it to the legislature? I mean, when you say manageable, I'd like to know what manageable has a number with it.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I don't have that with me, but the materials from our presentation in January and the May presentation to the LCPFP are certainly available, and I can re-forward those to you.
Thank you.
And when we talk about manageable, one of the questions that we posed that I assume you'll be getting to is vendors. And I know when we had a telephone conversation, you used the term manageable, and I picked up the newspaper a few days later and found out that refunds to businesses were being delayed. That's one of the reasons that Commissioner Innes is here to explain that a bit. But yes, that term manageable probably does need a definition. I think that was, roughly $130 million that are delayed payments, refunds, and so on to businesses for corporate taxes and sales taxes, if I recall. But Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we're spending some time talking about what's happened before, as opposed to, and that certainly can be helpful in terms of how we fix things going forward. I recognize that. But I guess the question I have then, I want to make sure that I'm clear. Historically, when either this governor or previous governors have presented their budget to the legislature, have we seen in the past negative general fund cash flow in those budget presentations, whether it was Governor Pawlenty, Governor Ventura, Governor Carlson, Governor Perpich? Have other governors come forward with budget proposals that would result in negative general fund cash flow for some period of time, knowing that we manage, as you're suggesting, with the statutory general fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. The changes in the cash position of the general fund are pretty longstanding due to some of the fundamental factors we'll cover a little bit further in our presentation. So, yeah, this is not a unique occurrence.
And Mr. Chairman, my only comment then would be, you know, that's interesting, and I guess unless we as the legislature are going to suggest that we shouldn't utilize that practice, that MMB shouldn't utilize that practice going forward, I'm not sure what I'm trying to understand the purpose of the, you know, let's get down into the weeds on you know, how low the lowest point of the cash flow projection was going to be for the budget presented by Governor Pawlenty. I mean, this is a practice, it sounds like, that's been around tripartisanly, if we include Governor Ventura. And unless we're going to suggest that the practice, the cash flow management practice, shouldn't be used any further, it seems to me like we as policymakers are getting a little bit too far into the weeds. And maybe I'm missing the point here, and that's certainly happened before. But I want to figure out how we can fix our problems going forward, because we absolutely have huge problems going forward. And maybe I'm missing the point of some of the questions.
Well, there's one question, and is the management, and I think that may be what you're referring to. But sometimes that management has gotten a bit complex. When you mentioned previous governors during the early 80s, when at least, well, several of us, I guess, were here in the early 80s when we were going through the Cui administration years, when we reached the point where the management got so complex that we weren't paying vendors on time, tax refunds were not being done in a timely manner, and we learned just the other day that tax refunds now are not being done in a timely manner to the business community. One might say then that roughly $130 million in loans from the business community to the state of Minnesota with those delayed payments. So there's the question of management within the various state funds, as I see it, but then there's the risk. I think Senator Metzen was focusing on the risk factor a few moments ago that you encounter when you're no longer being able to make your payments in a timely manner. And that's an issue. That's in part the $30 million. That's in part the delayed payments that Commissioner Innes is going to be talking about a little bit later on the agenda. But Commissioner Hansen, why don't we continue?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this segues. When we talk about management, it's what spectrum of tools do we have to manage cash flow? And in a minute, we're going to segue to the next chart, which shows you when we receive revenues over the course of the year, what our major payments are. So they, you know, on page 5, this is kind of the basic managerial constraints that we have.
Senator Pokemon.
Actual versus estimated seems to be on the wrong trend line. Do we know, what do we think November is going to look like?
Mr. Chairman.
130, 90, 180?
Mr. Chair, Majority Leader, what do we think it's going to look like, you know, later in the year?
For November 9th.
Yeah, I think you're right that, you know, we're running nearly $200 million below in October. November and December November's not such a big revenue month, and you know, there are a number of different factors that are going on, including the debt service payment transfer out of the statutory general fund into a dedicated fund. So there's a number of pieces, but you know, I think the easiest assumption is saying, yeah, it should probably be about as bad as what's coming in. That $200 million is a reasonable figure.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pogba,
when does the estimated numbers change after the forecast? Will we re-estimate that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And
Brett,
Mr. Chair,
does that come with forecast, or
it's a few weeks.
Few weeks. Yeah.
It takes us a few weeks to do that, but we're going to have to expedite that this year.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, a Majority Leader, if you think about it, when we deliver the forecast, which is just a just-in-time activity as it is, we're giving you, again, those annual, biennial revenue and spending figures. This is a daily estimate. So now you got to start drilling down those assumptions to a daily projection of which revenues are going to come in, which month, which day, fitting with the calendar year, all of those things, the contractual obligations to managed care entities. So we, again, go out, work with Department of Revenue, Health and Human Services, and other agencies to make sure we've got that right.
So, Mr. Chairman, just on page 5, as we were talking about, when I talk about and when Mr. Bielek talks about management, you know, is it manageable? It is looking at the spectrum of our statutory authorizations, and we have set obligations that have been put into statute over the course of the years, you know, as far as expenditures as well as revenues. So Jim is going to walk through that in the minute on page 5. You know, the next level of management in an issue like this is what we've talked about in holding the corporate or delaying the payment of the corporate corporate taxes. And we have and Commissioner Innes, I think it's 90 days. We have 90 days to process these. before we pay interest. So these will be processed probably, I'm thinking, early December. I think that's what he's going to tell you. So it is within our statutory window, you know, our the management authority that the legislature has granted us. And in this case, we are expecting, I think it's the property tax payments by early December. And we have that payment for the debt service at the end of November. Your next level of management gets to, are we, and we have been fortunate bipartisanly to have the cash flow account, and that has been our cushion for a long time. About half of the states in the country resort to some sort of borrowing, you know, to manage the same. Our ebb and flow of revenues and expenditures is common among states, very common. Your next level of management is to look to some sort of external borrowing. And at this point, we're not anticipating that we're going to get there. But if the trend that Senator Pogemiller just noted in our revenues continues, and we will know more in the November forecast, we may have to resort to that by the dips in March, April, and May. So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about today, or at least mention in response to your questions, I think it's helpful for us to start the dialogue and be planful about if we were to do that, to get it set up. And because it does take an amount of time to go through an RFP, figure out which method and how to go forward and set that up. And we may not need it, but I would prefer to be planful about it. And then when we discussed it with the ratings agencies this summer, they I think they expressed to us that we, you know, being if you're going to do it and it's a short period of time and you're planful about it, that's better than reacting at the last minute.
So, Commissioner, just so we're clear, then you're saying that there is the possibility that we'll issue certificates of indebtedness.
There's
you're going to begin planning for it. The only reason I'm emphasizing that at this point is the discussion that Representative Coles and I just had, because we did reach that point in the early 80s where we did issue certificates of indebtedness. The interest payments on those and how those have to be paid at the end of the biennium, they became an issue in and of themselves. And I was chairing a finance committee in the early 80s and was quite involved in that whole issue at that point in time. So that's kind of the third problem that you can encounter, because then you have to have the payment made by the end of the biennium and you're paying interest on those certificates, along with the potential of delayed payments to vendors and what we're already experiencing, delayed refunds on corporate and sales taxes to the business community. So,
Chairman,
that's the risk factor, I think, that we were talking about earlier. Senator Metzen.
I should know, but what's all included in the business taxes that we've been talking about that they're not getting repaid on a timely fashion, or they're getting their payments on a timely fashion? Is that corporate taxes? Is that alcohol? Is that – what does all of that include, the business taxes?
Corporate and Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, it's corporate and sales tax. All other vendors are being – and we expect to be paid –
Did we accelerate those payments for the business community to help us navigate through the fiscal problems the last 2-3 years, or were they prepay or anything? Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Is there any of that going on? Am I clear on that?
No, there isn't. We've done some things like
just the sales tax and that, there's been some prepayment. I'm just wondering, you know, they're prepaying to help us out of these situations.
Maybe we could have Commissioner Einstein.
Or do you want to wait on that? But in other words, the business community, I think, has been helping the state fiscal structure here by prepaying in some instances.
You're on the agenda later, but we're into it now. So,
sure.
And now we're at the point where, you know, they're trying to help us, it seems to me, over the years to prepay some of these taxes. Now it's time for us to pay them back. And now we're delinquent or late, and it just doesn't seem fair that we've asked that community to help us out. Now it's time for their payments, but us to help pay them back, not to help them out, but to pay them back. we're delaying things, so.
Yeah, Chairman, Senator Metzen, my name is Ward Ines with the Department of Revenue. Just to clarify, the portfolio taxes that are being temporarily delayed at this point are corporate franchise tax refunds and sales tax refund claims above $5,000. So that's kind of the universe of the ones we're holding back currently. I would add that prompt payment, I mean, how you define that. I mean, that the statute is right, as Tom Hansen talked about. The statute says after 90 days from the time the return was filed or the refund claim was filed, we have to begin paying interest. The hold would have to be on through December in order for the interest to kick in. So our target is always to get the refunds out the door prior to the 90 days, obviously. We do 95% of our sales tax refunds go out before 90 days. A third of those go out in less than 30 days. Also in the corporate franchise area, we've deployed a new software tool that also makes it easier for us to process the corporate return and ultimately the refund. So these numbers here are a little inflated relative to the previous years because we're doing two things. We have this new software program. We're processing in a quicker manner. In addition, we are implementing the integrated tax system phase two in December. So our goal was to get as many of these refunds out the door before we did that transition in December. The system needs to be shut down for about a week during the transition period. So we were being more probably prudent than usual about processing the corporate franchise tax returns. So this number is a little bit inflated. The current number, I'll give you an update right now. As of today, we're holding $128 million in corporate refunds and a little over $16 million in sales tax refunds. And that impacts about 700 taxpayers in total. So that's
Chairman, I understand we do have on the books prompt payment laws. So, is that a 90-day thing? So
Chairman, Senator Metzen, it's 90 days. The interest rate for 2009 is 5%. That interest rate is slated to go down to 3% on January 1st, 2010. So, if the hold is on for long enough for the 90 days to be triggered, that is the interest rate that will accrue.
Mr. Chair, are you? I'm finished. Thank you. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Ines, you use the word a little inflated. What is a little?
Well,
how much?
Yeah, Chairman, Senator, Representative Solberg, I would say that we've processed these probably about twice as fast as we normally had. So if this was a typical month, instead of being at 128, we've had about the hold on for 4 weeks. I think we'd be about half that. And it's, as I said before, it's a function of two things: the new software product, which has helped us a lot, but also the fact that we were putting more resources in this area because we wanted to get these refunds out the door before we implement phase two of integrated tax system. So it's kind of a twofold dynamic that was going on here.
Mr. Chairman, you also said you had to shut down the system for a week to implement the new one. If those refunds aren't out at that particular time, what's the status? What happens?
Yeah, good question, Chairman, or Chairman, Senator, or Representative Solberg.
Okay, just don't call me late for something. That's all.
I'm out of practice. I've been out of session for a while here. The goal right now is to transfer phase two of the integrated tax system late in the first week of December and probably be shut down until the 14th. So at that point, we will not be processing any refunds for about a week's period. The system will be up and running by the 15th, we expect. So if... as you said, if the hold is not released prior to the first week in December, those refunds probably won't go out till December 15th or thereabouts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, this is a good example of cooperation between MMB and Revenue. When we first got the numbers, there was much consternation because we didn't realize that Revenue was expediting the numbers. So the corporate refunds were twice what our state economists thought and twice what they normally are in October of a year. And we tracked that year after year and down to the day. And when we finally figured out that they were expediting the refunds, we breathed a sigh of relief. But it was as concerned as I've ever seen Dr. Stinson until we got Ward and the revenue guys on the phone.
But that expedited, I've heard, accounts for one-third of the amount. So there was still $90 million that was being held under the old system, so to speak.
Yeah, which gives you a little precursor to potentially what's going to happen in the forecast. I would think.
Mr. Chair, can I go back to the question on the short-term instruments of indebtedness? If I recall right, and I wasn't in the legislature but deeply involved, the instruments of indebtedness, when those were issued, there was, you know, it really put our, I think, our rest of our credit rating in the tank. What is anticipated if we go down that road, even if we start having to plan to go down that road, what does that do to our interest rates on general bonding, interest rates and others? Our interest, I should say, our ratings, not rates.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, joining me at the table in the red is our Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management.
Does she wear that because we're in the red all the time?
It's her hearing suit. But I had asked her to prepare a discussion of this because I did want to raise it with you today. But I think that, just to answer one of your questions, I think we get credit with the ratings agencies for being planful. As I said, based on our current projections, I don't think we'll need it, but we will, as we said to Senator Pogemiller about 15 minutes ago, we will redo everything after the November forecast, and I'm concerned at that point what our cash flow will look like. So engaging you in the discussion now and being transparent about it is important. But I had asked Kathy to raise, to walk through what that would be. It would only take a few minutes. And there are four options that she'll walk through with you, some less palatable than others.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, I really hadn't thought about the red implications. Sorry about that. I'll be more mindful next time. As the Commissioner said, under the Constitution and Minnesota Statutes 16A671, we basically have four options for utilizing short-term borrowing. The first is to advertise for competitive bids. That would be a full public offering, just as we would do with a general obligation long-term bond issue. The second is that we could negotiate a line of credit with a bank or the financial institution. The third would be to, in essence, do the first option, but negotiate that with a firm or firm of underwriters who would either act as a placement agent or buy the certificates directly themselves and sell them to others as well. And then the fourth option is to sell certificates to the State Board of Investment without advertising for bids. With any of those first three options, you know, you've got certain processes, whether it's a procurement process through an RFP for a line of credit, or to do a negotiated transaction, or doing advertising and public bidding requirements on the very first option. The SBI is the only one that does not require that sort of procurement or public advertised process. There are advantages and disadvantages, as your question identified, for all of these options. Not one of them is perfect by any stretch of the imagination. With the competitive sale of certificates of indebtedness, you've got basically four positives. You've got a tax-exempt cost of borrowing, which I would point out in today's market, as opposed to the market that we were last in the early 1980s, is considerably lower. So you were borrowing funds at a lot higher interest rate. Today's rates are around 1%, a little bit less than that. That's a positive, I guess, if we're going to be looking at that. A competitive issuance of certificates is very marketable, so you should not have any trouble soliciting interest on the part of potential buyers. We would have a fixed interest rate on those certificates, so we would know, and presumably a fixed maturity. You know, we've talked about all these certificates have to mature before the end of the current biennium. So you would be able to calculate at the time you sold them what the principal and interest payments were going to be. And finally, you don't have the RFP-type procurement process that you have with some of the other options. But there are some cons, some disadvantages. The first is this: you have almost no flexibility. Once you determine an amount of those certificates, that's what you're going to have, basically outstanding, until they mature. You can't prepay them early. You can't pay them down in bits. You're stuck with very little flexibility. Depending on the term of the certificates, this is a finance specialty, but they may not be what we call money market eligible. Let's just say hypothetically we sold certificates in January, and let's say we matured them in January of 2010, and we matured them late in June of 2011. That is a term that is roughly a year and a half, roughly 18 months. Money market eligible securities have a term of 397 days or less. Money market funds are the funds that are really looking for short-term paper. So if they're not money market eligible, because we have to mature them over a longer period of time, that could hamper marketability, quite honestly. We would need to prepare a full set of disclosure documentation. We'd have to prepare official statements. We would have to go to the rating agencies. We would have to do all of those things as we would normally do with a sale of general obligation bonds. And as some of you who are on the Capital Investment Committee who've seen me before know, one of the things that is difficult for us to do is to prepare disclosure documentation during a legislative session, because you as legislators, the governor, as the executive of the state, can be proposing things that could be viewed as material to potential investors. So as a general rule, we avoid doing things during a legislative session, like preparing or selling bonds or certificates. We are likely that we would have to get both long-term and short-term credit ratings for certificates of indebtedness like this. There are a separate set of rating criteria in addition to the normal long-term criteria. If they are amortized over a period longer than just a short, few months, we would very likely have to get both types of ratings. As I already mentioned, we have limited ability to prepay in advance of maturity. And as one of you mentioned already, we would have probably a large principal and interest payment due late in the biennium. The second option was the bank line of credit. Advantages: you have a lot more flexibility to draw and repay funds. You have a tax exempt. You can get a tax exempt cost of funds, although in this case the interest rate would probably almost certainly be variable rather than fixed. So if we make a draw in February of 2010, that rate will be based on an index as of that time. If we repay it, that's great. Then if we'd made another draw later in the fiscal year, it would be a new interest rate. So it's a variable interest rate. The bank line of credit, you don't need to go through the credit rating process. No short-term ratings or long-term ratings are required. The disadvantages are that you need to negotiate an agreement with a bank, and that can be a very cumbersome and time-consuming process. We would also have to go through some sort of a procurement, which is going to add additional time. If we did a negotiated sale of certificates, the advantages are, again, tax-exempt cost of funds. Those would also be just as marketable as they would be if we sold them competitively. And we might, and I emphasize the word might, be able to negotiate some flexibility with respect to draws and repayment of funds. But the cons are we might not be able to get that flexibility. We would, again, have to go through a procurement process. Depending, again, on the term of the certificates, it may not be money market eligible. We would almost certainly need credit ratings, and we would, again, need to prepare the full gamut of disclosure documents. Last but not least, selling certificates to the State Board of Investment. It theoretically does eliminate the procurement issues, which could save some time. And also, presumably, we could have a flexibility to negotiate the terms. But there are a number of disadvantages, the most prominent probably being that it would be a taxable cost of funds. There's no advantage to the State Board of Investment to offer us a tax-exempt interest rate on these certificates. Credit ratings under their authorized investment statutes are probably required here as well. We would need. Go ahead. We would need a couple.
Go ahead. You're just about finished.
I'm almost done. We would need an outside opinion, what we call a fairness opinion on the transaction, which would probably be both from a legal perspective as well as a market perspective, that the offer that they're making or that we're making to them is fair and competitive with their other investment alternatives. We would also need an outside legal opinion as to the eligibility of other non-pension trust investments, because if you remember, we can only borrow from their non-pension funds. So they've got a whole range of other trust funds that they manage dollars for, but there would have to be an analysis done as to whether or not those funds are eligible. We've not done any sort of an assessment of what might be available from those dollars to be loaned out throughout the biennium. And finally, the certificates are probably not a part of the State Board of Investments adopted asset allocation strategy, which means it would probably have to be modified by their, I guess I'll call them their constituents, whose funds would be affected.
Mr. Chair, what I'm really concerned about is, and that's good information, but what will happen to our overall credit rating when we go down the road of having to borrow short-term money? And I probably don't know, nobody knows the answer to that, other than if we go back in history, it's not good.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, you're right. Nobody knows for certain. Certainly, to the extent that we utilize options which require us to obtain credit ratings, that makes that possibility probably more likely. In any event, this would all be disclosed to them, as we've tried to be very upfront with them throughout in terms of telling them what our cash position has been and how it's been changing. So it's not as though they're unaware of it today as it is. If there is a downgrade as a result of this, it would certainly have some impact on the cost of borrowing. I would say that in the current market environment, interest rates continue to be really, really low, so the spreads relative to different credit levels continue to be pretty compressed. And the higher credit, I don't anticipate that there would be something, we would drop down to something in the AA category, presumably. I don't know what that number would be, and I don't know which agency might do something, but there could very well be an impact.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, we're operating under the assumption that if we ended up having to do it, being planful about it ahead of time, setting it up, and hopefully doing it for a short period of time would be better than reacting quickly and rashly next April, May. And as Kathy said, that window of time from the forecast to the beginning of session is really, really the time to do it, because of the disclosures. It gets very difficult during session to do anything like this.
I assume that, being that you brought it up this morning, that there's a fair probability that we may have to go down that road.
I don't know. We're managing risk, and we're trying to, it all depends. Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg knows as much as I do about the coming forecast, because he sat through two Council of Economic Advisor meetings, and I know what that information is, and I know that we're down $223 million, and I'm concerned of that we will have another deficit in the December 2nd forecast. So that's
we have a couple of other things on the agenda. What I'd like you to do is maybe just make sure you touch on the key points, and maybe with as much brevity as possible, because we do have a couple of other items on the agenda that we want to deal with. So,
excellent. Mr. Chair, let me just pick it up with the slide that shows the monthly inflows and outflows. It is a chart that should look familiar. It's been in some of the other presentations. I think it's just handy for your purposes to see when some of the major payments are coming in. both within the month and then how they come in during the course of the year. You'll see 2009 on the top left-hand side. Outflows for most of the year, big inflows coming in June. A similar pattern occurring in 2010. 2011, just for the record, although we're really focusing on 2010 in this discussion, 2011 will have a slightly different pattern, but it is a more negative cash position than even in 2010. On the next pages, I will just sort of introduce these slides, and if you want, or we can go into more detail with your staff at a later point in time, looking at the 2009 cash flows.
I'll just give us a quick overview, because I do want to be sure we adjourn a little before.
I will be, as you'll see, I'll be dashing through these. The next chart basically shows you some of the detail. This is just the first level of detail behind these nice summary charts that our staff have prepared, showing the major taxes, when they're coming in over the course of the year, spending over the course of the year. As you'll see, just from a cursory look at this, it changes from month to month in pretty substantial ways. That is fiscal 2010 on that chart, and then you'll see the statutory general fund look for that same period on the next chart. More for reference purposes, the chart entitled Cash General Fund Cash Advances Borrowing gives you a little bit of history on the general fund's borrowing with other funds in the statutory general fund over since 2004. You'll see that there have been transfers made in each of the years except for 2007. The level of borrowing, interfund borrowing, is what is particularly significant and particularly showing the fiscal stress that we're under right now. Continuing along, looking at another chart titled General Fund Revenue and Expense during August of 2009. That's just specifically there to address one of the questions that you put in your letter. How does this really look on a day-to-day basis? So it was an interesting question, and it's a new chart that we produced as a result, taking a look at the revenues and expenses on each individual day in the month of August. You saw the cumulative impact of this in earlier charts, but here you can see that some days expenses ran substantially higher than revenues. The reverse was true on other days. In general, this was obviously a negative cash month for us. And you can see the variability on a day-by-day basis. Taking it down even one step further, the next chart shows you where the sources of revenue were during that same month. How did those revenues break out between individual income tax, sales and use tax, excise tax, so on and so forth? So you're really getting into the detail and starting to see glimpse some of the assumptions and some of the work that's going in to these daily cash flow estimates that we produce and that we try to manage off of, and frankly have been really quite remarkably accurate if you think about the number of assumptions that are going into some of these estimates. Similarly, you'll see some of the major categories of spending on the final page, taking a look at how state payroll, agency operations, aid to cities, counties, education, so on and so forth, went on through that month on a daily basis. Charlie, is there anything you want to add to those charts?
No, I think finally probably conclude with page 13. Page 13 is interesting. At the top of the page, what it shows you since 2001, basically for the statutory general fund and the general fund, the the beginning cash balances at the beginning of a fiscal year. What this will show you is over time, our starting point at the beginning of each fiscal year has been declining. So that kind of structural disparity that's hidden when you start the fiscal year with lots of cash is now revealing itself because our beginning cash balances have been declining. When we had $1.5 billion at the beginning of the fiscal year, that was able to cover our spending earlier in the fiscal year. For fiscal year 2009, we started it with $836 million, and we're faced with spending $1.5 billion in July and August. So, again, the cash flow problems have structurally been there for a considerable length of time, in fact, decades, but are largely hidden when we have surpluses, reserves, and other things that contribute to positive cash balance. The bottom slide there, Representative Carlson referred to the history of kind of our borrowing. That's just a synopsis or a snapshot of what we did in the early 80s, the amount we borrowed by year, and the interest cost that we paid. And finally, to conclude, the last time that we made significant changes and recommendations to kind of improve cash flow was in 1992. In 1992, we first created the cash flow account to provide a cushion, and we also began to make some changes. Some changes are simple, like moving the LGA payment date from the 15th of the month to the 26th of the month. Again, on a daily basis, the 15th of the month is largely where we make school aid payments and causes a cash crunch. Finally, we made some changes in terms of electronic filing and sales tax and other income tax collections. So one of the final questions I believe you had on your list was, will we be making recommendations this session in terms of improving cash flow? There is, in statute, a cash flow report is required by January 15th, and that the statute requires us to present and examine options. And I would expect that as an outcome, we likely would be suggesting some changes that could at least marginally improve some of our cash flow. Some of the big structural changes, the disparity between what we spend and when we spend it, those are very, very difficult problems to solve.
And that was going to be a question I was going to ask, so you've touched on that. You will be making from the executive some recommendations potentially on cash flow management, probably similar to some of the things you were just outlining.
Mr. Chairman, we will.
And Mr. Chair, I think that is an important discussion to have. That being said, the cash crunch, the problems that we're managing through won't be resolved singly by some timing of individual payments. This is an overall state of the budget, the state of the economy, and its impact on our revenues that's really driving this issue.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. And Senator Pogonok.
Mr. Showalter, do you happen to know much education?
Mr. Chair, Majority Leader, you mean it's sort of the unallotment actions?
Yes. How much has been returned
to date? I don't. We would be happy to get that figure for you.
We've just done a rough calculation. I think it's about $370 million.
Okay.
What did you say, 370?
$370 million. But that's just the back of the envelope.
Yeah.
At one point, you were sending me monthly updates. I had asked for a monthly memo on how much money was being withheld. We got that once, and I appreciate it. And I'm just curious why
we can do that. I do know that when I send a forecast or anything to you, Senator, you always send me a nice email back saying, "Dear friend," you refer to me as friend. That's nice. It's the bounce back.
That's so nice.
And Mr. Chair, Majority Leader, quick look, we're in the same ballpark. We had about $300 million just taking a look at a couple of columns of numbers. So I think we're talking similar figures.
Mr. Chair, just one quick question. On the next chart, you got the column that says ITC. What does that stand for?
Invested Treasures Cash.
What's that?
Invested Treasures Cash.
Invested Treasures Cash. Yeah. So that's how much cash they have available?
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, Representative Wynn. Charlie was earlier talking about the total amount of money that's under estate management. That's the Invested Treasures Cash. That's what that's referring to.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you want us to come back on this budget instructions?
Yeah, that's the third item on the agenda. But, you know, maybe you're at the table now, but I did want to ask Commissioner Ines, we kind of bounced into your testimony and left it. Is there anything else that you would like to comment, because you were part of the first part of the agenda, that
right,
it's relevant to our discussion that we should know?
No, Chairman, members of the committee, I would just say that the hold has been on since October 16th. As I said, it's exclusively corporate refunds and sales tax refunds in excess of $5,000 per claim. The most updated number is $128 million on the corporate side and $16.1 million on sales tax. And that constitutes 461 corporate taxpayers and 294 refund claims for sales tax. So about 750 taxpayers impacted at this date. So far, we've gotten few calls, maybe a half dozen calls on the sales tax refunds. We've gotten one call on corporate. I think most corporations were not expecting the refunds to be processed as quickly as they have been processed, so I don't think there was any great appetite to receive these refunds in October or November. Usually they come, you know, tail end of December anyway for the corporations. I think the news story may have prompted a couple calls. But in an ideal world, I think MMB and the Department of Revenue are in conversations on a daily basis about the cash flow situation. I think we're cautiously optimistic that the hold will be extinguished and sometime in December, hopefully the earlier part of December, so we can get those claims out the door. You know, the 90 days, if we hold it until January or so the hold's in place, then you probably get into the 90 days running and interest start accruing. If we get them out prior to that, the vast majority will never owe any interest. So I think we're in that window still where we can get these out without having adverse impact on the general fund as far as interest payments. The vast majority of these corporate refund claims came in first part of October. The deadline is October 15th for corporate filings. So most of them came in early October. So the 90 days will not run until early January. So I think we have window opportunity not to be adversely impact the state and hopefully get these refunds out still in a timely manner and meet the expectations of the taxpayers.
So the timely manner means what? Because I remember I commented earlier that the faster processing accounted for about a third of it.
Right.
So arguably then two-thirds of them would have been expecting usual treatment in terms of when the refund would have typically come.
Chairman,
what would that usual treatment have been and as compared to what in all likelihood is going to happen?
Right. Chairman, you know, I asked our people for what is the average processing time for a corporate return, and it really does. There's wide variation depending on the complexity of the return and how much auditing is going into it. So for the corporate ones, I think it's typical we try to get those out within 60 days. So, you know, 60 days would run for a lot of these will be middle December. So that's why I think we haven't gotten many inquiries about where's my refund from the corporate side of the equation. The sales tax ones, a third of those go out within less than 30 days. We call them quick claims. We send those out within 30 days. 95% go in less than 90 days. So very few of we ever accrue interest on the sales tax refunds. We did make the decision to send out anything under $5,000 in denomination. Figuring that might be a good proxy for smaller and medium-sized businesses. So we've sent those out. So the ones we're holding, as you can do the math, are about $16.1 million in refunds being held, and it's 294 taxpayers. So they're relatively sizable sales tax refunds that are being held. And there may be Commissioner Hansen and I have talked repeatedly about maybe starting to meter out some of the ones. Maybe there were sales tax refunds, metering those out and holding back some of them. So we're analyzing on a daily basis, trying to determine what's the best thing to do from both the state and the taxpayer's perspective. And I'll do my best to keep you posted. If you want weekly updates on what we're holding, how much and how many tax refunds, I can provide that, if that's helpful.
Probably would be, being that it's so high interest right now, a good idea. Senator Pogamiller.
Chairman, Commissioner, appreciate the explanation on all that. Had you checked with those businesses ahead of time? I mean, did they know that you were ready to give it back, but we're withholding it temporarily?
Chairman, Senator Pogamiller, we did not. One of the decisions we did make is that if we had been in negotiations or an ongoing audit with the taxpayer and there was an expectation that a refund check was going to be cut in short order, we let those go. So anything that was kind of in the queue where we knew there was an expectation on the taxpayer that there was a check forthcoming, we let those go, and then we stopped those where there hadn't been any taxpayer contact, there hadn't, you know, kind of the normal course of business ones we held. But there are some, you know, we were in negotiations and those, and the taxpayer had an expectation that it would be in the mail. So we actually let those refunds go, Senator. So,
Commissioner, I think a phone call to our staff, prior to that newspaper article would have been a good idea. We were a little surprised. Your explanation, I think, has been a good one. You can't think of everything I know, but I do know Senator Bach's office was a little surprised. We were a little surprised. So.
And Chairman, Senator Pogelman, your point is very well taken. We were a little surprised ourselves. Not that the hole was in place, but you know, when a taxpayer has inquired about the status of their refund, we have given them a full explanation. We actually informed the taxpayer that's been a cash flow issue. We're helping to manage the state's resources, and it happened to be that the one of the taxpayers that inquired was the Star and Tribune asking for their sales tax refund. And so we were very candid with them. We told them, here's the situation, and that's actually but we should have done a better job of informing that this hold was going to be in place, and especially after we knew it was going to be more than a week or and we will do better in the future, Senator.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coles.
You don't tick off people who buy their ink by the barrel, right?
Yeah.
don't tick off people who buy their ink by the barrel, I think, is the lesson there.
I think a good way of putting what we're talking about here, and I had an understanding when I chaired the Education Committee and the Education Division of Appropriations before that, no surprises. And I was a bit surprised, quite frankly, due to that phone call that I referenced earlier when you indicated, Mr. Showalter, that it was manageable, and then, like I say, a few days later you pick up the newspaper and there's talk of delayed tax payments and so on, and your department was referenced as being the one that had made the request of revenue to hold back on those payments, according to the article. Whether that was accurate or not, I don't know. But the point I'm making is let's try to avoid surprises on some of these big questions.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we had decided to. I'm trying to remember when we were on the phone with you and Representative Solberg for our monthly meetings, but I don't think we had decided. I'm trying to remember if we had.
But remember, I asked specifically about cash flow. And that's,
I remember, but I don't think we had gotten to the point where we were.
But anyway, we can move forward with no surprises.
Oh, yeah. Is why I brought up the.
What I want to do is move to item 3 on the agenda, because I do want to be out a little before 11, and we still have a staff presentation. But while you're here, the third point on the agenda was what instructions were going to be for the 2010 supplementary budget.
Mr. Chairman, members, you have the memo I sent to cabinet, into the cabinet, and I can restate what I have said in there. I don't know if I have much more to offer. If you're looking for,
I didn't hear.
I was going to say I don't know if I have much more to offer than what was in this memo. If you're looking to cut corners and try to get done by 11, I can answer questions.
Yeah, are there questions then relative to?
Or I can
instructions that were in the memo.
Sit down, and I'll be here till the end. So if you think of something, I can come back up.
Okay. Well, thank you. Then we'll jump
are
to.
Senator
Pogelman.
Are you aware right now of emergency or deficiency items that we're going to be confronted with? Or I don't suspect you know them all yet, but are there any ones that you could let us know about now?
The chief is by the only thing I think of.
Chief?
Mr. Chair, Majority Leader, the only one that I can think of right now is looking at some of the higher ed grant programs. There's some of those that are oversubscribed, and we're trying to work through some options on funding those. So there's potential there, but I'm not sure that's going to be a deficiency request or not.
But it is about a $23 million problem, if I recall. It's created the second year when they moved the dollars into the first year.
Right.
So that's a big issue that we'll need to deal with.
Yep.
We will double-check, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogelman, but we usually try to let you know of those emergency items as soon as we can.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Hansen, in your letter, the second to the last paragraph, correct me if I'm reading too much into this sentence, but any proposed budget changes should be limited to emergency items and specific initiatives. Mr. Chairman, are you giving direction to look at, we're talking about this cash flow, and we talk about borrowing, and we talk about shifts, and those are very important to maintaining cash flow, but there's one other piece, which is a reduction in spending, and we haven't talked about that at all. right. Is that implied in this sentence that you have sent to your agency heads, that we should also be looking at where we can tighten our belts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, yes, it's, you know, none of us know what the forecast is, but I'm anticipating that it's probably going to be a deficit, and at this point, we will probably look to resolve it through spending reductions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Solberg.
Just to Mr. Showalter, you piqued the interest on deficits, and part of the economic forecast will also be increases in anticipated expenditures, particularly in the area of health and human services. That's kind of the economy does that driving force, whether we like that or not. Mm-hmm. Will you expect some major changes in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, good question. I don't know what the figures are going to be yet. On a monthly basis, I believe, you know, the medical assistance program has been tracking pretty closely with previous forecasts. So I'm not anticipating a big swing there. I know on the Minnesota Care side, however, there has been increased demand. So generally, I think there's always some risk on the health and healthcare side that could compound any revenue changes. You know, the other issue that's lurking out there is just, you know, federal healthcare reforms, any changes in assumptions that would go with that. But that will not be folded into the November forecast.
Thank you.
And I would appreciate it. I've always, with my history, been kind of involved with the education funding, and I would be interested in how you plan on addressing that $23 million. Sure. Because that means access to a lot of students, and at a time where the economy is in difficulty, we have a lot of people with the enrollment increases, and that's what's driving this, and more students qualifying, doing the right thing, you know, and to make sure that we make sure they have the opportunity to continue their educational programs. And that impacts, you know, Minsky, U of M, our private colleges and universities. So it's a big issue.
Yeah. And Mr.
Okay.
Senator Pogleman.
And then Commissioner, based on the memo from Commissioner Ludeman the other day, do you anticipate a proposal on GMAC from the executive branch or not? Or is that issue done with now in the mind of the executive branch?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't know. I can check. I don't know.
Because remember, we had breakfast with the governor.
Yeah.
I'm trying to just ascertain whether something has changed from that discussion or not.
And I will check.
Okay. Thanks.
You know, moving them to Minnesota Care, something that there should be a dialogue with our health and human services people, and I'm sure there will be, is that $10,000 cap. Because a lot of the people on the general assistance medical care have high, relatively high cost needs, and they'll hit that $10,000 cap fairly quickly. And so what happens then is the question if they are put on MinCare. But let's go to the staff then. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe if you wouldn't mind sticking around, in case there are questions after they get done with their presentation.
Chair of Pension Commission, see you later.
Mr. Chair and members, Matt Mossman with Senate Fiscal Staff. I think that you just recently had passed out a packet at the last meeting, and we're going to try and get it back up on screen here. We looked at a little budget calculator that we put together just to kind of be able to get a sense of order of magnitude of some changes that would occur – in spending in order to balance the budget in fiscal 12 and 13 based on kind of two planning estimate scenarios. And chairs, you requested that we put together some examples, and we did that, and that's what's in this packet here. And we also then, as you flip through, printed the page for the relevant example, and they should follow in order. I'll walk through them. One question was, just in the way of background, again, one of the conversations was to look at some examples based on the $4.431 billion deficit that is forecast for fiscal 12 and 13 in the state's budget documents. And if there are a couple scenarios here that were looked at, one is if you make additional budget reductions and put them in place, starting permanent budget reductions approved by the legislature in this next legislative session that become effective beginning in fiscal 2011 and carry forward into 12 and 13 as base reductions, what would be the reduction that would have to occur effectively in the base? And these were computed across the board. And so this first example here is to say that if you did an across-the-board reduction in all budget areas of 9.4% beginning in fiscal 2011, you would, over the course of the 3 years, reduce spending by $4.431 billion and bring the fiscal 2012 and 13 planning estimate period into balance that way. Now, just one thing. If you think of the fiscal 12 and 13 amounts as a structural gap, starting in fiscal 2011 would help address the budget balance by the end of 12 and 13, but wouldn't any that assumes that some amount here, if you look at the example, the second page that goes with that 9.4% example, it would effectively mean that you would be leaving a positive balance of about $1.5 billion because you would start cutting right now in fiscal 11 and let that roll forward into fiscal 12 and 13. So you would actually use savings from this current biennium to address fiscal 12 and 13. So you'd have budget balance, but you still wouldn't yet have structural balance in fiscal 12 and 13. One other thing I want to note then about this this first example, and then I'll be able to walk through some of the other ones more quickly, is we put a little, there's some notes that show up on the right-hand side. You'll see it's actually, I apologize, not printing very well, but basically what the note says is federal maintenance of effort may limit reductions. And that is there just to remind you that in fiscal 2011, we still are under federal maintenance of effort requirements for higher education and education in terms of how much we can reduce spending in those areas given the fiscal stabilization funds that the state is receiving. The note also shows up next to Health and Human Services just a general comment in the sense that a major part of that budget is health care, and a major part of health care spending under the current federal stimulus law is limited in terms of the reductions that can be made through December 31st of 2010. In some of those areas, it would mean, now the state grant program as a shortfall has already come up, not all of those budget areas are subject to the maintenance of effort. So the note's kind of general, but it's just there to remind you that that's also a limitation that would have to be taken into account. Moving through then the examples. Moving through then the examples, the remaining ones. If you started with that same number of $4.431 billion deficit, but you did not begin making any reductions, any change to the spending pattern until putting together the fiscal 12 and 13 budget, the reductions across the board at that point would have to be 12.2%, and that compares to the 9.4% if you start a year earlier. The third example then that you asked for was to options 3 and 4 here compute a similar percent change, but it's based on looking at these other budget pressures that you have, the general assistance medical care program you just recently brought up, Mr. Chair, and so this is an estimate, a calculation that's built on, again, the assumption that if something was done in the way of general assistance medical care funded from the general fund as it had been, was put back in place and was put in place at the level essentially as the program was at prior to the governor's veto, that if that was added in, as well as a buyback of the governor's action to change the revenue recognition of school districts for property tax revenues, and also building in inflation across the board, inflation estimate for the planning estimate period. If those were brought back in and the numbers, the percent reductions in spending were computed based on that $7.25 million gap, if you started in fiscal 2011, at that point you would need to make a 15.5% reduction beginning in fiscal 2011, permanent reductions, and those permanent reductions would carry forward in the base into 12 and 13. If you wanted to resolve the same amount of spending reduction, but not until the beginning of the fiscal 2012 and 13 budget period, you would make reductions of 20%. In spending, and again, that's across the board in all budget areas, education, higher education, health and human services, and all the other budget areas, tax aids and credits. And then these last two scenarios were holding K-12 education at no reduction and looking at what the percent changes would need to be. And these, we computed both of these based on the $4.431 billion. If no reductions were made to K-12 education at $4.431 billion, if you started in fiscal 2011 and made permanent reductions to all other budget areas, you would have to make a 15.7% reduction across the board. Again, that's an across-the-board number. You couldn't do that much in higher education, obviously, because of the federal maintenance of effort. If you took the same scenario and began those across-the-board reductions with the exception of education in fiscal 2012 was the starting period, you'd make reductions of about 20.3% across the board in order to balance the budget. That's at $4.431 billion. We did not recompute those scenarios holding education harmless at the $7.25 billion level. Frankly, the percent changes are just astronomical. It's about a third of the budget, basically, at that point, if you hold education harmless.
And we don't really have one when you pointed out with that first chart the requirements under the federal stimulus, because that would also include higher education.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's kind of the next phase. We realize that it would probably be, really accurate, it would be helpful to build in some sort of limiting factor that would hold those amounts to the federal maintenance of effort limitation and then have spillover to the other budget areas. That said, it's probably not quite that simple because in those budget areas, in higher education, for example, the maintenance of effort requirement applies to our general fund funding to the institutions of higher education. So we could, in fact, cut the state grant program. That's not under the maintenance of effort requirement. Likewise, in K-12 education, there are parts of the budget that are not subject to the federal maintenance of effort requirement. It's the general education formulas to which the limitation primarily applies. There are some other categoricals that could be reduced.
Maybe something one of you could check for me with financial aid, and I think there was an increase in the Pell Grant, wasn't there, Don? And I think there is a long-standing requirement of maintenance of effort there outside of federal stimulus package, but maybe we can check with our fiscal analyst for that, just how that that works, because I think the stimulus package did have an increase in Pell, if I recall.
Mr. Chair, I think the point here, though, is as far as building it into the model, there are all those interrelationships, and it's very hard to build it into a model. The state could decide to decline to participate in the Pell Grant program, probably, and that's not likely a decision that would be made, but that's not necessarily one that should be built into a model. It's more a decision that has to be made separate.
I guess my question wasn't so much the model, but just the policy of whether there is a separate maintenance of effort requirement or not relative to the state grant program, because the Pell Grants went up. But we can check with the folks that work on that.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either Mr. Mossman or Mr. Marks, as I'm looking through this and trying to make sense out of it, and I think I followed the discussion, but I want to boil it down just a little bit for my simple mind. As I look at the current 10-11 number, the expenditure number under current law is $31,330,000,000, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that's the current spending that's anticipated to happen in the general fund budget after the governor's on allotments. And the only caveat I say to that is it's not the appropriations base that is carried forward, because on allotments don't change the appropriation base. They only reduce the spending.
Okay. The next question then, I guess I want to make sure as I'm looking at these numbers, Mr. Chairman, and trying to understand this, Mr. Mossman, what is the projected spending for 12 and 13 under current law? So as I understand the unallotment process, that blinks off at the end of the biennium. So under current law, what is projected spending for 12 and 13?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, if you go to there's a column that says fiscal 12 and 2012 and 13 current estimates. It's about the fourth from the right column.
Right.
The $40 billion number.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Mr. Markson, can you explain to me why, as I go to the next page, that drops to 38, and then I go to the page after that, it's up to 41. I want to understand what the current law projected spending for 12 and 13 is. What's the forecast tell us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that is because the current estimated spending is... Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, my apologies. It is the current law spending is the $38 billion. It's because what you're seeing in the model's interactive here. So it's because what you're seeing on some of those subsequent pages is that when you know, the example that's being shown on some of these pages is that that spending is being reduced beginning in fiscal 2011. And that assumes that is being done as a permanent reduction to the base, so that it is actually carrying forward as something that would show up in the forecast as lower projected spending at that point. In other words, if you come back this legislative session and make a permanent reduction in education or in any one of the budget areas, the fiscal 12 and 13 estimate would change simply because you're making a base change and the planning estimates reflect the base being carried forward.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to try. I know you want to be done, and I do too, but I want to understand then the first chart, because it appears that we're making a 9.4% reduction in fiscal 11 spending, but we're showing projected 12 and 13 spending of $40 billion, so we're going up. I'm just...
Do I have a slide backwards in the model?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, you're asking a very good question, and it could be a glitch here that we have in the model.
Mr. Chairman, I have then again, we're talking trees here, and I want to make sure that I first see the full forest, and then we have to talk about the trees. I get that, but so the $38,736,000,000 spending projection is the 12 and 13 under current law. If we maintained the governor's unallotments, what would the spending for 12 and 13 be? Because as we're talking about reductions here, we're talking about cuts. We're actually talking about cuts in rates of growth to a large extent. So I just want to make sure that we fully understand the numbers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, and just before I answer, just to confirm, the correct number, $38,736,000,000, is the one shown on the second page, and that fits with the fund balance.
Okay.
The question on what would the number be if we continued the governor's unallotments is probably not a real simple one,
okay.
And it's complicated because the current number, the $38,736,000,000 includes paying back the aid payment portion of the education shift, for example, which is reflected under current law. If that wasn't paid back, there's $1.1 billion of difference there. There are also a number of questions in the Health and Human Services area where the governor's on allotments actually reduced formulas, and we don't have accurate estimates on what that would be in fiscal 12 and 13. I don't know if those have been done, but we don't have numbers on carrying that forward. I think I could simply say it's going to be at least one billion less than the 38.7 if the shift isn't paid back. But I'm not sure on those other ones.
Mr. Chairman, I think two more questions. Can you tell me, Mr. Marks or Mr. Mossman, what the projected revenues under current law are for 12 and 13?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, the current revenues as of the end of session after on allotments were at $34.655 billion for fiscal 12 and 13.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Marks, can you just give me, I don't have a calculator with me and I'm not very good at math.
Mr. Chair, may I correct that? I had carry forward built into that, $34.3 billion. Is the revenues for the biennium itself,
okay,
without carrying forward any.
So just rough numbers then, projected revenues for the 12 and 13 biennium are about $3 billion more than projected spending for the 10 and 11 biennium. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that is correct. There's, you know, the one thing that I was actually going to kind of circle back to anyhow was there's a lot of things going into the difference between the – one important thing, for example, going into the difference between the fiscal 10-11 spending and the fiscal 12 and 13 spending is there's also some one-time – a major piece of one-time federal stimulus money that basically expires. So, for example, the temporary federal medical assistance, the matching rates – that was about $1.3 billion in fiscal 10-11 that goes away. So you see a big disparity between the 12 and 13 and 10-11 spending estimates, partly just because of federal stimulus money.
And, Mr. Chair, one last question. Under current law, projected spending is set to increase. I understand some of the complexities, and I'm just talking forest here again, not individual trees. But projected spending is we're talking about increasing spending under current law of over $7 billion, which is something in the 20% range. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, the $7 billion is correct. The percentage I'm not positive of, but would be about there, yes.
I calculated 22, but again, math isn't my strong suit. Okay, Mr. Chair, I would just comment, and then I promise I'll be done. As I heard about this meeting this morning, reported on the media, there was a lot of talk about we got to start to address the 12 and 13 problem, and I think that's absolutely correct. A year ago, we had a lot of conversation as this commission about concepts like zero-based or priority-based budgeting, and quite candidly, I think the legislature failed miserably at accomplishing that because, not because we didn't intend to do that, not because we didn't have good intentions, but because we simply ran out of time. And Mr. Chairman, whether it's an effort to truly embrace the concept of priority-based budgeting, whether it's an interest in adopting what Senator Pogemiller called the Coles framework during last session, where we decide how much money we got to spend, and we decide that first, and we figure out how we're going to do it. If we're going to actually make structural changes to right the state of ship, we've got to start today, and we've got to start. So I guess it's really a process question. I'm not suggesting that you disagree with that, but I want to understand, because I think the public deserves to understand. I mean, there's a big iceberg out there, and if we don't start turning the wheel today, the ship's going down and we don't have enough lifeboats. And so I'm curious, from a process perspective, either Mr. Chair or Senator Pogemiller, how this commission intends to start working today, tomorrow, the next couple weeks, the next couple months, to start the process of actually turning the wheel, because we can't turn the ship of state on a dime. We had good intentions, I think. I think there was some effort bicamerally to go down this path of priority-based budgeting, but the reality is that 4 months isn't enough time to do it. We need 18 or 24 months, and we've got to start it today. And so I'm curious if there is some thought or some process that is either going to be put in place or has already been discussed, so that we can start that, because I'm concerned about the iceberg that's there, and we're running out of time to avoid it.
Representative Coles, when you say we failed on the priority-based budgeting on the House side, we put a major effort into that, but we quite honestly lacked cooperation from the commissioners, with one major exception, and that was the Department of Natural Resources. When you mentioned time, that may be part of the reason. And the reason I mentioned that was that they had actually started prior to the legislature coming into session by about 5 or 6 months in terms of going down the road of priority-based budgeting. But we didn't get a lot of help, quite honestly, from the other commissioners. It may have been the press of time. It may have been a philosophical difference. I know one commissioner, there was a deep philosophical difference. He simply didn't want to do it because he said it would create a morale problem within his department. End of discussion. I did have a brief conversation at one time with Commissioner Hansen, who agreed that he would try to help in that regard, and that's kind of where it stands now, but I'd be very open to having a discussion with Commissioner Hansen about that, very open to discussing it again with several of the commissioners that I had conversations with before, as did the division chairs. But it's a two-way street. If you're going to have priority-based budgeting or zero-based budgeting — no state in the union, by the way, has zero-based budgeting.
Understood.
Though a number of them use it. You do have to have cooperation from the administration in that regard. We learned that very quickly, but I, for one, am still open to it if we had that help.
Well, Mr. Chairman, knowing that the players who were in the game last year are still in the same game, right? The pointing the fingers doesn't help, right? So what are we going to do as the legislature, working with the House and the Senate together, right, to come up with a new way of trying to resolve the issue, right? doesn't help to point fingers and say, well, they won't play. Okay, fine. Then let's redefine the game so that we are part of it.
Okay. Any other questions of the staff?
Mr. Chair, is there another meeting scheduled at this subcommittee?
Okay. If there are no questions of staff, then our next meeting is December the 14th. That is a change. We had originally had an earlier date, but the forecast will be coming out early December, and I think that that's going to be presented to us on December the 2nd. Mr. Mousman, you have a...
Mr. Chair, it's actually one thing we noted on here, but just mentioning the forecast, all of these numbers are really only valid through the forecast since it's such a short time frame from now that these will all change.
Yeah, as the commissioner said earlier, and as you folks work on this, all that changes when we get the new forecast. So that'll be at 9:30 a.m. December the 14th in this room here. This is our next meeting.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fogelman.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out real quick, Senator Senjum was ill today. So he's absolutely interested in this work. And I just want to make that point.
Yeah, and we had... one of our members is dealing with the health care issue, I guess, in D.C., so it wasn't a lack of interest on his part either. With that, then, no further questions, comments, meeting adjourned.